You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
But this one was coming toward the party, though at a great distance, and soon he realized it might be moving faster than he thought. He became alarmed, fearing it to be a Volodon, the flying counterpart of a Granum, or some other monster they knew nothing about. Olaman had said there might be others. He called to Tally, who saw it too. He looked at Spekran and saw how distracted he seemed, then turned to Deliani behind him and asked what it was. "Believe it or not," she said, "it's a means of transportation. Humans are too large and cumbersome to fly the way we do. What you see is a gigantic machine to move them from place to place." Jilin caught his breath as the thing passed high overhead, a plume of white mist trailing it, and all at once noise from its power sources could be heard. "It's moving incredibly fast," he thought, turning his head and watching until it was out of sight in the western sky. The cloud-like streak hung in the atmosphere above. "Where does the white smoke come from?" asked Jilin, fascinated by the sighting. Calling shakily from his raven, it was Spekran who answered. "I've heard of that before, never seen it, and I haven't a clue." With the sun almost overhead, Deliani called ahead to Tally. "We must look for a resting place for the Eilon." Before long, they saw a small lake, and Deliani indicated they should land. The Kirins spoke gently to their birds, stroking their necks, and with Tally in the lead, they descended and touched down near the water. The riders dismounted, took a few moments to stretch and regain their earth legs, and dismissed the Eilon to search for food. The Kirins sat down by the glimmering water and quietly ate a lunch packed for them early that morning. Hardly hungry, Spekran nibbled as he glanced at the small band of travelers. "A woman," he thought, "a girl, and two lads, one of whom I can't see, on a mission more treacherous than any of them can fathom. I fear our success or failure will depend on me, my decisions and abilities. Me, the least suited for flying, perhaps for the mission." He shuddered and tried to think of something else. "This will be our last homemade meal for a long time to come," said Deliani. "Let's enjoy it and hope we have others we enjoy as much along the way."
"It hasn't been a bad trip so far," said Hutt. "We have a long way to go, but I love flying. I could do it forever."
"It might seem like that before we're through," thought Spekran glumly. Standing up, he brushed off his gown. "Shall we call the Eilon?" he asked Deliani. "We can't stay here forever," he thought, "though we might wish we had." Deliani whistled, then called the five ravens' names. Within moments, they returned. "Let's be off," said Spekran wearily, the Kirins climbing aboard their Eilon. They lifted off, slanted to their previous altitude, and continued eastward, moving ever farther from home. By late afternoon, all were ready for rest, bird and Kirin alike. They saw a wooded area ahead, a small stream meandering through it, and Deliani indicated they could spend the night there. They glided in for a landing, and the Kirins climbed off and began to explore. Their preference, of course, was to sleep in trees, as they did at home. They searched a few, mostly oaks, and found clean, dry holes, but not all in the same tree. Then they looked for food and ate a supper of berries, mushrooms, and tender greens. Still in no mood for conversation, most stayed to themselves. Hand in hand, Tally and Jilin took a walk and talked quietly. At dusk, the others climbed to their tree holes, crawled in, and prepared for the night. Realizing this was the best they could hope for under the circumstances, they gradually relaxed and watched the sun set in the direction of home. Jilin and Tally watched the sunset from the ground, then climbed to holes they had selected for the night. The ravens settled into branches above. Taking turns sleeping, one always remained awake to guard their masters as they slept. several red squirrels had been observing the Kirins and cautiously approached their locations, then withdrew after satisfying their curiosity. Later, the call of a horned owl awakened the travelers from an uneasy sleep, but otherwise the night passed uneventfully. The first to arise early in the morning, Speckerin climbed down the tree and began searching for food. "Our first night is history," he thought. "How many more will there be?" It was sunny and cool, with a promise of warmth in the air. The others soon joined him, and together they ate a breakfast of berries and greens. Then they summoned the Eilon and departed their first refuge. Continuing eastward, they began to see long, narrow lines traversing the terrain below. They were usually straight, and sometimes intersected similar ones going in other directions. Suspecting they were related to human beings, Hutt called ahead to the magician. "What are those strips or channels below us?" Speckerin was a bit more at ease today aboard Ocelom. Looking down, he identified what they were seeing as passageways constructed by humans for travel. He had never before seen one, but in training to be a magician, learned they are manifestations of human civilization. Gripping his Eilon intently, he turned toward Hutt. "They're called roads. I'll tell you more when we land." Soon they touched down for a rest, and he continued his explanation. "Humans build them, lay them out through fields, over marshes and rivers, carve them through forests and into mountainsides, even through mountains, so vehicles designed to travel on them may proceed uninhibited. We have nothing like them, no need for such things. Except for our present venture, our travels are almost always close to home. That's how we live, and that's how we like it. At least I do," he thought. "Will we see humans on these roads?" asked Hutt. "I don't know," said the magician. "We haven't come across any of their dwellings, but roads are evidence humans inhabit the region, and we might be entering a more populous area." "Do they ever live in trees?" asked Hutt, "like we do?" "I doubt that," said Speckerin. "They'd be rather large for that, wouldn't they?" chuckled Hutt. "They'd fall out." He laughed, picturing the hulking creatures lounging about, trying to eat, sleep, and carry on daily activities in that lofty environment. "In English," said the magician, "their dwellings are called houses. I have not seen one, but I have studied Kirin documents describing their many shapes and sizes. Throughout history, as you know, we've kept a careful watch on our human neighbors." "What does a house look like?" asked the invisible Jilin. "They vary widely around the world," said Speckerin. "In this region, they usually have upright walls and a roof that comes to a point, but not a single point, as you might imagine. The roof is made as if two more walls are slanted to cover the house and come together at the top edge, allowing rainwater to be shed from the structure. Quite a clever arrangement." "It's time to move on," said Deliani. They lifted off and continued eastward. Within a short while, Jilin called from the back of Loana, "Is that a house way up ahead?" He pointed, but of course no one could see him. Then they all caught sight of a mustard-colored building, tiny from the altitude at which they cruised. Viewing it with mild nervousness, but keen interest passing beneath them, they continued looking, heads turned rearward, until it became very small and far away. They did not see a human, but this was the first structure erected by humans they had seen, and it indicated the nearness of the giant race. Hutt had never seen a human, and felt a peculiar mixture of curiosity and revulsion when he considered it might actually happen. In the late afternoon, they landed in a glade of trees near a lively, bubbling stream. They released the Eilon to find food, collected their own for supper, and selected uninhabited tree holes for the night. Luckily, this time all were in a single large oak. With darkness falling for a second time on the small troop, they readied themselves for sleep. From his snug hole, Speckerin heard rustling above, and for a moment wondered what it was. With the ravens giving no hint of warning, he relaxed and drifted off to sleep. But another party, whose interest in the travelers was paramount, had arrived and settled in the top of their tree. Chapter 17. During the night, a steady rain began to fall, but the Cairns remained dry and comfortable in their tree holes. Again the first to awaken, Speckeron stretched and looked out into a dim, misty, and humid forest. He climbed out onto a branch. For the moment the rain had ceased, but heavy clouds hanging low overhead showed promise of more to come. This morning, for the first time since their departure, he missed the comforts of home, his bed, his kitchen, and his old fireplace. "Too early to think thoughts like that," he said aloud, shaking his head. "It will be a long time before you enjoy those things again, if you ever do." The question, he thought, is how long? How far must we go, and exactly where are we going? During his 40 years in practice, communication between common magicians and those in the upper echelons had diminished to nothing. He had suspected something was wrong with Kieran magic, and now assumed this quest was related to that. "If something's wrong with Kieran magic," he thought, "what about mine? What will happen when I need it?" He had previously had no idea where the guardian magician, his court, and the hanging stones might be. No magician in his acquaintance knew. Messages and teachings always arrived via magical devices such as Calamars. It was impossible to tell from where they originated. Now he presumed it was from the east. But in reality, he recognized, standing in the early morning mist, he knew very little. And that was beginning to wear on him. He could not know the particulars of Ollamon's secrets. That was a given. If their small party had any chance of success, he must not know more than he did. But success at what? And where? What might they do once there, if anything at all? Realizing he was fingering the calamar in his belt satchel, he pulled his hand away quickly. He hadn't used it much in recent years, but knew why he searched it out. With its purported ability to see past, present, and future, it might answer his questions. This must be why Ollamon was beleaguered by Granums, he thought. Through a calamar or similar device, he had obtained knowledge, making him consummate bait for his foes. A gentle rain began to fall, interrupting Speckeron's ruminations. Climbing down the tree to damp ground, he began foraging for food. Deliani soon joined him, while the three youngsters slept, the two gathering enough for all, then calling the youths to breakfast. They found a dry area near the trunk and ate quietly. Soon they would be moving on, having nothing else to do, nowhere else to go but farther into the unknown. Yet on this gloomy morning, each was thinking of home. "We're but 2 days from home," thought Tally. "How much farther it seems. We can't go back, of course. We have a mission to fulfill." She knew this, but had qualms about it, especially since, very possibly, she was their enemy's only prey. But at least, she thought, Jilin and I are together. "Let's prepare for departure," said Deliani. She called the Eilon, and they landed on the ground and waited attentively. The Kirans placed leftover food in their satchels. "We will need rain coverings," said Deliani. Each had a lightweight, waterproof jacket and hood. They removed them from their back sacks and put them on. Then they mounted the Eilon, lifted off, flew up through the trees, and leveled off just above the treetops. On this dank morning, the early light of day was intermingling gradually with the darkness of night, causing dim illumination in the forest. They couldn't tell the direction of the sun, and their easterly course was determined entirely by Jilin's calamar. As they progressed, Tally in the lead, the rain became heavier. They found it difficult to see, even to keep their eyes open. They were not accustomed to tolerating this sort of weather. At home, when weather conditions were bothersome, they stopped whatever they were doing until it was over. They never felt pressure to persist, as they did now. As the morning wore slowly on, the waterproof cloaks became less and less effective, rainwater leaking in at the ends of sleeves, seeping in at collars and around hoods, and eventually getting through the tightly woven fabric itself. Uncomfortable as anyone, Speckerin looked toward Tally and wondered how long she wanted to keep flying. All at once the wind rose, buffeting them from side to side, the Kirins clinging ever more tightly to the saturated necks of their ravens. The brave birds, which in the wild would long since have abandoned flight under such conditions, struggled onward at their small master's behest. A jagged flash of lightning, followed by a jolt of thunder, caused even these Eilon, with lifelong instruction and discipline, to shudder, falter, and then accelerate, beating their wings wildly. Their masters held on grimly. Through desperate entreaties and the influence of Curlace magic, they were able to quell the birds' fears, regain control, and direct the unsettled creatures back into formation. More flashes electrified the sky, and thunder shook the atmosphere, the beleaguered Eilon lurching and wavering in the rising wind and now torrential rain. It was all the riders could do to prevail over the birds again, as primordial instincts all but overruled their many years of training. Now the storm raged unabated, the Kirins miraculously managing to stay together and even in a semblance of order. Tally remained in the lead, but was questioning whether they should continue. "I'm afraid this isn't right," she thought, "but we must reach our destination, and halting won't help that." Tally and Jilin were in command because of their knowledge, but this party had only one experienced leader. When the weather turned from a source of discomfort into one of obvious danger, the other four, even without a spoken word, looked to the old magician for direction. Knowing this would happen eventually, he was surprised it occurred this early. Nonetheless, as soon as he sensed their need, he flew forward and took the lead, and Tally dropped back. Signaling at once for descent, he hoped they could find suitable ground on which to land. Struggling downward through drenching rain and low-hanging clouds, they could see little of the terrain, and communication between them was difficult. Their efforts were expended in holding on to their Eilon and trying to stay close to those ahead. Finally, with difficulty, they saw a wet landscape beneath, marshland, with no solid area to alight upon. Sailing onward above the marsh, they were soaked to the skin. Eventually, the wetlands ended, and they were coursing over firmer ground, but still couldn't find a place sheltered from wind and rain. Then, as if laboring through a bad dream, they entered a dense and nearly impenetrable fog. Unable to see ahead, Speckerin led them to a higher altitude. Suddenly, through a break in the clouds, Deliani caught sight of a grove of trees to the south. She called Speckerin's attention to it, and just as he saw what she was pointing to, it disappeared again into the haze. He gave signals for a change of course. They turned their Eilon to the right and flew blindly for a long while. But all at once the grove was there again, and they landed on a relatively dry patch of ground under trees affording some protection from the rain. The shivering Kirins slid heavily from the ravens' backs, relieved to be on the ground, exhausted from the harrowing flight and eager for warmth. Speckerin counted the Eilon. To his dismay, there were only four, Hutt, Tally, and Deliani standing next to their own ravens. He glanced quickly about.
"Jilin, lad, are you nearby?"
"Where are you?" cried Tally, suddenly frightened. There was no answer, and they came to a terrifying conclusion. Jilin was no longer among them. Chapter 18. No one's to blame, said Speckerin, trying desperately to remain calm and think clearly. But one of his charges was gone, and the thought of it was like an icy wind blowing through his heart. Deliani was distraught. Flying behind Jilin, she had considered it her responsibility to keep his Eilon in sight. It must have been when I saw these trees, she said, her voice quivering, and pointed them out to you. I was distracted and didn't keep track of Luana. Tali was pale and quiet, deeply worried about her dear companion. Hutt echoed the feelings of all. No matter what happened, we must find him. Sensing their master's pain and feeling the loss of Luana, in unison the ravens cawed stridently, then stopped to listen. Everyone listened for sounds from Jilin's Eilon, but heard only wind and pelting rain. He was on the left side of the formation, said Deliani. We probably lost him when we veered to the right. In the storm, he might not have seen the signals for landing. Gazing up into a dark sky, raindrops spattering his face, Speckerin asked for help. If there is a source for good in this world, good magic or simply good, please help us in this time of need. I haven't asked for much, but I ask now. Help us find Jilin. Looking back at his shaken friends, soaked, desolate, and wondering where their companion might be, he knew they needed some kind of encouragement. We abhor being separated, he said, a knot in his stomach. But Jilin's resourceful and will look out for himself. He can't be far. We'll find him. But we must get warm now. We must locate dry wood, if possible, and start a fire. The stunned, shivering band spread out, and under particularly dense foliage, found twigs, sticks, and branches dry enough, they hoped, to burn. One item the magician included in his baggage was a fire-starting device. He retrieved the stubby instrument from his kit, just as soaked as everything else. After several vain attempts at bringing the moist instrument to life, a flame burst from its end, to the relief of all. Trembling, he touched it to the wood, and it ignited immediately. Staring into the flames, he spoke to the others. It would be folly to send a search party under these conditions. Jilin might be looking for us. Our fire could lead him here. With a fragment of optimism, he picked up a branch and threw it on top of the flames. We must build this fire and keep it stoked. It might bring him to us. They spread out again into the surrounding shrubs and trees to locate flammable wood. A fire was soon burning readily, and more wood was brought to stoke it. They gathered enough to keep it going throughout the remainder of the day and the night, should it be needed. Though it didn't seem like much, they realized that for the moment they could do no more than this to be reunited with their friend. Before long, considering the circumstances, they had quite a satisfactory blaze. We must not catch cold, said Speckerin. Strip off your outer garments and dry them by the fire. He sat down under a tree a short distance away to contemplate their alternatives. When the weather clears, what should we do? Send one or two of the party to search, leaving the others behind? All of us go and leave the fire behind? And what would the searchers do? Seek Luana, since Jilin's invisible, and call his name from aboard our Eilon? What about Tali's toe ring? And, of course, there's my Calamar. He shuddered, thinking of it. Should I employ it now, after ignoring it all these years? Could I make it do what I want? Would I uncover something I'd wish I hadn't? I don't know the answers to these questions. I don't know much of anything anymore, and my head's beginning to whirl. He arose unsteadily, stood quietly for a moment, then walked back to the fire. Tali was standing there, staring into the flames. The ring on her third toe glimmered in the firelight. The beleaguered magician approached her. A few days ago, you contacted Jilin through your ring. Is it possible? I was thinking of just that, said Tali. And I think not. I'll try, of course, but I believe the moon was responsible for activating it. She peered into the murky sky, rain against her face, her blonde hair saturated. There's no moon, but I'll try. She sat down by the fire and took off the ring. Then, with the others watching, she mechanically went through the routine she had employed by the stream several days earlier. To the disappointment of all, it was to no avail. After a time, she gave up and despondently slipped the ring back onto her toe. The wind and rain continued throughout a dismal afternoon. Just before dark, the rain ceased and the breeze died down for the first time since morning. As the last light faded from the sky, the small party gathered sadly around the fire to rest and wait. The four islands stood beyond them near the surrounding trees. Eventually, one by one, the Kirans reclined and drifted off to sleep. But one, Spekeren, who concluded all this was his responsibility, sat in the dark gazing into the flames. Periodically he stoked the blaze when it dwindled, and he waited. Throughout the night he watched the skies and saw the clouds gradually diminish. Stars began to shine through faintly, but not the moon, which remained shrouded by the covering. Deliani and Tali slept fitfully. At one point in her sleep, Tali cried out Jilin's name, and Spekeren was the only one to hear. But as the long night passed, he outlined a plan in his mind. "At least we'll have a strategy," he told himself, and eventually he relaxed. Toward morning, the overcast began to part, and stars filled portions of the sky. Suddenly the moon shined brightly through, and Spekeren was moving to awaken Tali when the orb was obscured again behind an opaque bank of gloom. The old magician settled back heavily into his place to wait out what was left of the night. The first light of day finally brought promise, a rosy glow on the horizon and clear skies overhead. The sunrise was spectacular, but Spekeren took no pleasure in it. His thoughts were only on the missing Jilin. Where might he be as the sun rises on this sparkling morning? What could he possibly be feeling? Will we ever lay eyes on him again?
Kirans, The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kirans, visit www.kiranbooks.com.
You have been listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.